Welcome to Dear Watchers, a comic book omniverse podcast where we do a deep dive into the multiverse.
We are traveling through the storylines before and after that inspired or took inspiration from this week's amazing alternate universe. And your watchers on this journey continue to be me, Guido. I was going to call myself Gonk, but that might be a little esoteric for the reference today. We'll see. We'll get there.
Hello, darlings. It's me, Rob, Master of the Dark.
Oh, all right. That works.
That's our special featured superstar's usual intro. And Guido, I have two questions for you. What's new and how's your head?
Never had any complaints. I'm answering them in reverse order. And in terms of what's new, this is an exciting episode for so many reasons. It is our first foray into something past Marvel and DC. And mm-hmm. we have been planning for a while to go out beyond the boundaries of Marvel and DC, and even beyond the boundaries of superheroes. And I think we found the perfect first alternate universe to do that with. So that's exciting. We both also have an extensive backstory with the subject of today's episode. So that's exciting. And it's also tied into multiple episodes, which mm-hmm. is really exciting. Hopefully everyone likes this enough that it warrants multiple episodes and that people will stay with us for multiple episodes. But we'll reveal later why there's at least one follow-up episode that you'll need to hear if you're even remotely interested in anything that comes up today. So this is really fun. It's a bit of an arc we're doing, and yeah, really
and
quite fun.
We're beating around the bush, but they'll know who we're talking about because her name is going to be in the title of this episode, and it's Elvira, Mistress of the Dark.
It is Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. So let's get underway.
Yes, and if you are joining us for the first time, after a quick summary of our alternate Earth, we have origins of the story, what is inspired this other reality, exploring multiversity, diving deeper into our alternate universe, and pondering possibilities, examining the impact of this visit to the multiverse. And with that, dear watchers, let's shimmy into our slinky black dresses and welcome to episode 45, where we'll check out what's happening in the multiverse with today's alternate universe. And today, we, as the Council of Watchers, monitoring the comic book omniverse, we have declared the following question. What if Elvira entered a multiverse of horror movie worlds?
And our question comes from an Earth with no number and no reference yeah. point, because it doesn't exist in a multiverse of a large publisher that has been indexed or annotated. So really excited for, I don't know, maybe we should have come up with a number, but whatever. Earth 666. So
yeah, perfect.
On Earth 666, Elvira enters a multiverse, and we will get into a lot more detail when we get into the issue that presents us with this multiverse. But very long story short, the ghost of Vincent Price reveals to Elvira that movies are like dreams. They're little pocket dimensions. And this is a quote from the issue we're reading. A universe unto themselves, and they may not be real, but like dreams, they're powerful, and there is a reality to them. And Elvira ends up falling into many different universes, a multiverse of horror movies. And we will go into a lot more detail about what that means when we get to our mm-hmm. multiversal issue. But that is the summary, I think, of today's alternate Earth.
Yes. And Guido, what is your background with Elvira, Mistress of the Dark?
Well, we were born into reality the same year. So we have been destined for each other since 1981.
That's true.
And I have loved Elvira since 1987 or earlier, when my mother, I don't know how many reference points I would have had for her. Her show wasn't national. She was a big advertising spokesperson in the 80s. We'll get into a lot of her backstory in a few minutes. But I do know the movie came out and I saw it immediately with my mother. I was 6 years old. My mother, who would not let me see Dirty Dancing, somehow thought it was totally reasonable to bring me see Elvira and watch it all the time on the VHS tape that I had taped off HBO when it finally aired on HBO. Maybe because it had a little dog and referenced classic horror movies, which my mother always got me into Hitchcock and stuff at a young age and MST3K. So and that was it. I mean, as so many queer people, she just became my icon for a long time. You and I have seen her at conventions. I have read everything I can about her. I've read her autobiography. We've watched every special, every interview, every iteration of her. I've read every comic I can get of her, which we'll talk about that history. We have many of her autographs and her memorabilia, and I just am completely and utterly obsessed with Elvira.
Yes.
And what is your background with our Mistress of the Dark?
Well, I'm a much bigger horror fan than you are. I came to Elvira really late. I think maybe it's because, you know, I'm so much younger and, you know, prettier than you. So I mainly knew her as a spokesman, like you said, and I associated with Coors and all these other products. And I knew that she had these movies. I knew she was on TV. You would see her on specials and pop up on Halloween episodes of sitcoms. But I had never watched her movie until I actually met you. So I just knew her as this figure from the 80s and 90s. But I think she always felt a little too... It's like you were saying, your mom wouldn't let you see Dirty Dancing but see Elvira. I think she was always a little too dangerous for me to see as a kid. Maybe that's just like...
Meanwhile, you love like the most exploitative horror movies that are that's the grossest true. Things in the world that I won't watch. But maybe you just weren't watching those when you were younger, I guess.
Well, and I think really that was the power of her image, where she was just such a striking image, where I think a lot of parents, I don't remember my parents ever forbidding me from watching her, but I think it was a little taboo, as opposed to, you know, a horror movie where someone's getting killed with a knife. For some reason, that was much more acceptable, I think.
Well, I think in her career too, which we listened to the audiobook of her autobiography after I read it. So I think you and I know a lot about her. But the late 90s, she was much more in the background, and for a variety of reasons, I think. But I think the age difference between us is probably really important, because Mistress of the Dark hit and I was into it. It was on HBO. And then I think by the time, you know, she lost her Coors spokesperson sponsorship in the mid 90s, and then I think she faded away for a few years for mass audiences, and that might have been the time you were coming up, so that might be why.
And she's part of this grand tradition, which I've now become obsessed with,
of
horror hosts. And I remember basically when I was growing up, there was her, and on TNT was Joe Bob Briggs with Monster Mission.
Yeah, we just watched last night.
We just watched last night. He's now back on the air. So it was the two of them, and you would see Count Floyd from SCTV reruns. And that was it, because this phenomenon of horror host had gone completely away when it was huge in the 1960s and going back to the 50s with Vampira and Zachary. So yeah, she was really one. Her and Joe Bob were really the last remnants of this being in the mainstream popular culture.
Yeah. The other aspect I'd say in terms of our background is something we were talking about before we started recording. You and I both have there's the queer draw for Elvira for a lot of people, which I think has to do with her campness and a lot of other things. But she's also one of those rare people who has a persona that is very hard to separate from the person, like a RuPaul, like a Pee Wee Herman used to be. I think that got changed due to news when he was arrested. But RuPaul is another great example of someone who you and I both love and lots of people love. But that is a persona that Ru is doing much of the time. And we don't spend quite as much time with the person RuPaul Charles. We spend a lot of time with the character RuPaul. And Elvira is very much the same. I remember when I was younger, I thought it was a urban legend that she was this redheaded woman named Cassandra Peterson. I did not think that was true. I thought she was black haired and Elvira. Obviously, I didn't think she was, you know, a witch or supernatural or anything like that. But I thought she was Elvira. I thought that was the person. So you and I tend to like people like that.
Yeah, her and Pee-wee were both credited as themselves in the
characters.
It says Elvira in this movie and Pee-wee in that movie. Rue, of course, uses, you know, her own name, but as you said, there's a mix there. And yeah, it seems like it's something that has kind of died out. I think, you know, one person who comes to mind who just, you know, passed away was, you know, Gilbert Godfrey. Like, that wasn't his real voice. But you never heard Gilbert speak in his real voice ever.
Or
Rodney Dangerfield and
Bobcat.
Too.
What's his name?
Yeah, Bobcat Goldthwait. You know, who now as a director has become. Yeah. You know, for so long in the '80s and nineties was that. Yeah, that seems to be something that you don't really see. Maybe because now with social media, you have more insight, and reality TV, you have more insight into people's work and behind the scenes features on DVDs. That stuff isn't really there anymore.
I'm sure there's a lot of reasons, but let's dig into these origins of our comic book omniverse that we're exploring today.
Yes, we're gonna knock on the door of a house of mystery with today's origins of the story.
Right now on this very show, you're gonna get the answer to all your questions. Our amazing story begins a few years ago.
I feel like if we weren't so lazy, Guido, we would be replacing all those sound clips with old classic horror movies to really get in the mood. But we could just imagine them.
Yeah, everyone should imagine it because it's a great idea, but it's not happening. So just imagine it.
So we're going to talk about Elvira's long history, surprisingly long history.
Yeah. So before we get into the three issues we covered, let me give some story to Elvira. So she debuts, as I mentioned, in 1981. She starts on a local access network in LA, as many horror hosts do, starts to be distributed on VHS and a little bit more nationally syndicated, and then really hits it when she starts to become an advertising spokesperson in the mid-80s. So 1985 comes around, and she has her first foray into comics in a reboot of House of Mystery for DC, Elvira's House of Mystery. Her movie comes out in 87, so she has, you'd think, a bit of a boost there, at least for people like me, but the movie didn't do so well. So House of Mysteries canceled. There are, over the few years, there's a Marvel adaptation of her movie. It's a pretty faithful adaptation. Great cover art by Joe Jusco. One of our prized possessions is an autographed copy of that, cover art by Joe. And then there's some stuff, like we have a Personality Comics Presents. It's one of those biography comics that was coming out. Yeah. Around the early 90s, there's an issue telling her story. And then the biggest moment, of course, in her comic book history is 1993. The Claypool series launches. More on that when we get to that issue. But her Claypool series actually lasts for over 10 years and 166 issues. So it is a huge run that ended up having a small print run in the end, very hard to find and costly issues, but that is really quite something if you think about comics and runs of comics. Really something. We'll talk more about that. So then from the time that series ended in the mid-aughts, 2000s, to 2018, she's not present in comics. There was rumors that there was going to be a new title in the early 2010s. It never happens. And then in 2018, Dynamite gets the license to Elvira, starts collaborating with her. We'll talk a lot about that. But since 2018, so for the last 4 years, Dynamite has been publishing a lot of Elvira books, specials that they crowdfund, and then a few, an ongoing that then just spawns a bunch of miniseries, which is some of what we're talking about today. So she has quite a presence in comics for the last 35 years.
In some ways, it almost always felt like a throwback to like, say, Karloff, Boris Karloff in the Gold Key comics and things like that, where there were these licensed figures, these real people, real characters that were licensed. And it seems like it was really popular in the, you know, 50s and 60s. I don't know if it went later, but then, like, she really seems like the one person that has stuck around in all these different decades as a licensed character.
And I think we'll see the evolution in the three comics we read. We'll see why the first one might not have lasted very long, why the second one lasted really long, and why the ones that we're reading right now are probably, hopefully, going to stick around too. So I think we'll see that evolution. But you're right. Definitely her first foray, which we can get into now, is a throwback to the 50s.
Yes, totally. And that is Elvira's House of Mystery, number one. And that's from Double D Comics. Oh, I'm sorry, DC Comics.
I was like, wait, you're making a mistake, but now I see what you did.
Little Elvira joke there.
I get it.
That's from January 1986, and it's called Elvira's Quest. I wonder if that's a pun on ElfQuest.
It could be. The font, I'd say, in the issue looks like it could be. So this is written by Joey Cavalieri, penciled by Ron Wagner, inked by Bob Ochsner, colored by Liz Berube, lettered by Kurt Hathaway, edited by Sal Amendola. This is a reboot of the Bronze, maybe Silver Age. I don't know a lot of the House of Mystery history at DC, but the pretty famous EC-esque, Crypt Keeper-esque host that has a host telling these different stories in the House of Mystery. And so this is a reboot of that series, and she is the host. So this is her first comic book appearance, which is why we read it today. But our focus was really in the wraparound and in her presence in the book and how that was written. There are three different stories, I think.
I believe
three.
So, yeah.
Maybe four, even. I don't honestly remember, and we read it a few hours ago. But there are a bunch of totally standalone horror stories that are written by different people and have art by different people. And she is just in between each story with one or two exceptions where she's on panel in the story. So we read it, though, because it's the introduction to her comic book voice and image. What'd you think?
Well, right away, I liked it a lot because I think Joey Cavalieri really did get her tone great. And I think it sets up the classic Elvira thing of, like, she's being chased by a mob of people who want to run her out of town for being a witch or for being different. All the great stuff that's in the first movie, too.
Well, that's what's cool is this predates that movie. Now,
oh, really? Yeah.
Of course, if she... This is the one series where I couldn't find a lot of backstory on her involvement. She owns... Cassandra Peterson owns Elvira. So they had to work with her. And the other runs that we read today, she's very closely connected to, deeply involved in. And yeah, we have a lot of insight into that that we'll get to. This one, I'm not as sure, but based on her, I'm guessing she had a lot of control over it. So maybe she had some of the ideas for the movie. It was filming, obviously, later the year this comes out. So perhaps that's why. But I agree, it foreshadows
a lot. Yeah, big haunted house that she basically stumbles into.
And then the townspeople, so in the wraparound story, she ends up flipping the townspeople with a magic perfume. And they end up acting like the teenage kids in her movie who are obsessed with her, and they ask for her autograph. And so there are a lot of echoes.
Even in the movie, there's the love potion scene where they don't fall in love with Elvira. They fall in love with each other. And here it ends also with a love potion. So all these kind of classic.
She might have had a lot of. Yeah, she might have had a lot of collaboration with Joey Cavalieri. I'm not sure. But I agree that Joey gets her voice perfectly. I mean, we read a lot. I mean, we both read a lot of Elvira comics over the years, but today we read a lot of them also. And it's really remarkable to me. Again, this is 5 years into this character. She's not the phenomenon that she is now. And still, there's something so consistent from the first three panels he writes on this first page through to the stuff we read that is actually not even published yet, being published next week, that we'll get into. There's something so consistent about her voice. And you know, he makes a bawdy joke that gotta find a way to duck them. They don't mean to use those pitchforks for a roll in the hay. That's on the second panel. And it's well tuned to like DC, right? This is DC. It's meant to be a little family friendly. And I think Elvira's always pretty family friendly. She just likes to push that line. And I think it's great.
Yeah. And what's also really cool about this is it does have continuity with the older House of Mystery, where the old horror host Kane, or the old Crypt Keeper character, is also in this. It's kind of part of the story. She sees his portrait on the wall, then she just starts to interact with him. So there is this lineage between the older House of Mystery and this new one. I'm kind of surprised that this only lasted 11 issues, because she's really the kind, at the end, almost surprised that in her long history of comics, she's never gone back to being this Crypt Keeper horror host character.
Well, so I think part of it, and this is going to be a little bit of a segue into the next one, but we can stay on this for a bit. But part of it is, of course, the challenge here is she's not a character in the stories. And that's what's different. So while her persona that we know of her is a horror host, I think when you pick up a comic that's Elvira, you want her to be the main character. And what House of Mystery does is just make her the wraparound. And so while she has this great voice, these great one-lines, and while this first issue has a little bit of a story going on, she's really relegated to the background. She gets to make a joke after each story that refers to the story. So very horror host-like. But I think, I don't know why it got canceled for sure, but I know that most fans appreciate every other run, she is the character in the story. She is not the host of someone else's story.
Yeah. So let's make her the main character, because if DC was just dipping their toe into the Elvira pool, next we're going to jump into the deep end of the clay pool. And that is Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, issue number one from Claypool. And that's from May 1993. And it has two stories in it, Play or Pay and A Big Hand for a Little Lady, part one.
All right. So the first story is scripted by Paul Dini, penciled by James Fry, inked by Terry Austin, lettered by Kevin Cunningham. And the second story is written by Joe Duffy, penciled by Dan Spiegel, who also does the inks, and lettered by Carrie Spiegel. The reason I emphasize those names before I get into some of the background on Claypool a little is Paul Dini goes on to create Harley Quinn. So 2 years after this, so there is a lot of proto-Harley Quinn, I'd say, in his writing.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Terry Both Austin is one of the most famous comic book artists. And then Joe Duffy co-created Power Pack, just huge 80s, 90s writer who's still writing, but just known for a lot of cool creations in the 80s and 90s, especially, again, Power Pack. So the caliber of people Claypool used to get, and so before we get into the issue, Claypool Comics is founded the year this title launches, so 93. They're most known for probably this title. They have a few other little titles that, like Peter David had a story there and Steve Englehart had a story there. So a few other major people there, but they didn't last very long. In fact, they primarily, so the company apparently published just over 300 issues. Elvira was 166 issues. So the majority of their output was really Elvira. And in 2007, that ends with issue 166 of Elvira. And apparently it had something to do with Diamond. The print run was too low. I think Diamond wouldn't carry it anymore. And so it ended up with a cancellation. So Claypool is an interesting small company based in New Jersey, where you and I are also from.
Mm-hmm.
And sadly doesn't exist anymore. We'll get into where that license ended up. But that's a little background on Claypool. And then this series, just before we dive in, because this is such cool history, in addition to the names of people who were involved in this first one, I mean, Kurt Busiek, Marie Severin, Fred Hembeck, Frank Strom, huge people worked on this run of Elvira. Like, mm-hmm. this is some of the most famous legends of comics who are writing Elvira, Mistress of the Dark comics for Claypool. So it is such a cool run. It was just reprinted finally for the first time ever by Dynamite. So they got the license to the Claypool comics and published a first volume omnibus of the first 23 or 25 issues. Anyway, that's the backstory on Claypool. What did you think of the first story that makes Elvira the lead character?
Yeah, I like this a lot, too. I think here is where we really see Elvira, the character that we know as, like, the horror host. And she's such an interesting character because she only popped up in these little segments on her TV show. So I'm always kind of thinking, like, so much is connected to really the start of the Mistress of the Dark movie, where she is working at this dinky TV station and is hosting movies, and that's so much of what then you see in this series and in the next series that we're
which we
talk
know
about
is
too.
Autobiographical.
Yeah,
we
totally.
We know from her memoir that you know stuff in the movie, which actually shows up a little bit in this first story, where you know they drop the weather map down before she was even done recording. All of that happened to her, so it's fun to see that. It essentially makes this comic a little bit autobiographical even, or I guess mm-hmm. biographical, since she wasn't scripting. And that's cool.
Yeah. And like you were saying, there is a lot of similarities to the Harley Quinn character in that she is this anarchic character, but that she also takes no guff from the men in her
life.
She's
a badass, sexy woman.
Yeah, and the men are always trying to control her, take her money, all these kind of other things. But, you know, she really always is putting her foot down. But at the same time, is still also, you know, lusting after men, is always fantasizing that, you know, especially in the second story, the Joe Duffy story, that, you know, the person who's her admirer is going to be rich and successful and hot. So, like, what's so
great
with this
character? And it's a horrendous clown.
Yes, horrendous clown. But yeah, they're able to have it both ways, really, with her being like this, you know, super strong, confident woman, but also kind of being, you know, wanting a rich hunk guy. It kind of almost in TV, I think of like Blanche Devereaux on Golden Girls, you know, someone who's able to be like a powerful woman, but also be, you know, super horny for men all the time at the same time.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, part of the DNA of Elvira is empowerment through sexuality,
mm-hmm.
which is very cool. And again, I think that has to do with some of why there's a large queer following for her, because that's really important for sexually marginalized communities. But I think all of that is here. And this series, they actually collaborated mostly with her then husband, who was also her then agent. So he worked with Paul Dini and actually Mark Evanier, who's a very famous writer, editor in comics. And that was because they were both West Coast based. And they worked primarily with Mark Pearson, who helped them break story. And Cassandra would then work through Mark, and then it would get over to the writer through.
And like I said to you, I'm pretty sure Mark is drawn on panel as one of the production assistants in the Joe Duffy story.
There are dozens of references in every issue. It's one of the things, you know, I think when we get into the multiverse, we'll be talking also a little bit about why she so lends herself so much to a meta story. But for sure, that's here. there are references to famous Hollywood people. There's reference in a later issue to Zachary Lee, another horror host that you really mm-hmm. love. There are, even at one point, she's watching Batman the Animated Series and then has like yes. a parody Batman, and they actually tease about lawyers, and that's in a later issue of this Claypool run. So there's so much with her and parody and satire mm-hmm. and also just homage in a lot of ways, I think, to the classic Hollywood stuff. And all of that is here in both Joe Duffy's story, which is also a little bit homage, I think, to like Big Trouble in Little China, it seems like, with the yeah. font of the heading. And then Paul Dini's story, definitely.
Yeah, and I was thinking, too, one thing that works because so much of her is rooted in old Hollywood and Universal horror and things like that is these are in black and white. So it gives mm-hmm. it that kind of timely, almost older quality to it. Her, even as a character, you know, she is black and white, right? Mm-hmm. Because she's That's got true. The white skin and the black dress. What did you think of, like, the art here being this monochromatic?
Yeah, like, I think you're right that it works really well. There's also almost a cartoony but sexy element to it, which I think works also for depictions of her because she yes. is very like cheesecake, and that yes. is essentially cartoon, just writ real. And so this does a good job of that. I mean, at times there will be a like hyper realistic drawing in some of these issues, but that tends to be to then contrast to the cartoony world that they've placed her in here.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is, I hope that Dynamite keeps collecting it because I think it's a fantastic run. And I've been trying to collect the issues for years, and they are, as I mentioned, very hard to come by. And I really want to see the rest of the storytelling in this run because it's so fun. It's a, mm-hmm. you know, surreal, supernatural, but with her like grounded in her real character as a horror host and breaking the fourth wall a bit and doing all that stuff that we love and that I think continues in her next comic book
yes iteration. Not to give ourselves some deja vu, but the next comic is also called Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. And not to give ourselves some deja vu, but the next comic is also called Elvira, Mistress of the Dark.
That was such an Elvira joke. Oh, and, good job.
Oh, yes, that is from the previously mentioned Dynamite. And we're going pretty recent now, jumping all the way to July 2018 with the fabulously titled Time Scream, Chapter 1.
All right, so this is scripted by David Avalone, who we have a lot more to say about later, penciled by Dave Acosta, who also did the inks, colored by Andrew Covalt, and lettered by Taylor Esposito. As mentioned earlier, this is the launch into her Dynamite time, which continues through to today. And it's not a hugely prolific output, I think, especially perhaps during the pandemic, the main titles sort of didn't come back for a while, and then some tie-in miniseries kept happening. And as I mentioned, they've crowdfunded a few issues, a really clever one during the pandemic called Omega Man, one called The Wrath of Khan that's actually about Comic-Cons, and then there's a forthcoming one called The Death of Elvira. So Dynamite's doing a good deal with the license, and David Avalone is the almost exclusive writer of all of these stories. And we're really excited. I'm going to reveal it now and mm-hmm. remind everyone when we get to the next issue. Our next episode is an extensive interview with David. We had a great time with him recently, yes. and he talks about everything from his career to constructing a meta story to constructing a multiverse and lots of detail on Elvira, including how Cassandra works and what she's approved or disapproved in the book. So yes. we are so excited to share that episode next week. But mm-hmm. for now, what did you think of David's relaunch of Elvira with this issue?
I mean, I think this is as close to perfect that you can get in terms of hitting the Elvira voice and also hitting all the check marks that we want from Elvira, where there's some fourth wall breaking. It's rooted a lot in horror. It's also rooted in the past as well, thinking about Haunted Hills, how that's like her thrown into a Roger Corman horror movie.
Yeah, so let me jump in there and explain that this issue launches what becomes time travel for her. Mm-hmm. So she's not yet multiversal. She has a coffin that when she gets into it, she gets pulled through time. And this first issue has her encounter the Shelleys. And then at the end, the cliffhanger is that she's going to encounter Edgar Allan Poe. And meanwhile, Lord Vlad Dracula is on her tail and tracking yes. her through time.
Yeah. To me, this is what it would be. And this is, I guess, the amazing thing about comics is this is to what I think an Elvira TV show or movie would be, but you need like a huge giant budget to do this because she's jumping through time and there's all, you know, all these giant sets. And that's what I think is so, you know, amazing about comics is like you can basically have that cinematic feel to it, but on a fraction of the budget.
Well, and we learned a lot from David, who works in Hollywood mm-hmm. still. In a lot of roles on a lot of different movie sets, has written for TV. So I think that influence shows up in his storytelling. And then in a little bit, we'll talk about the way it shows mm-hmm. up explicitly. But I agree with all of that. I think that, I mean, I love the Claypool series too, but I think that David took her voice to the next level and tells an ongoing story, which the Claypool series doesn't really do, and brings in, like you said, the horror elements, which are really important to her character, but everything is funny. And again, there's this constant fourth wall breaking, which is a really important yes. aspect of her character. You know, even she references the audience of the comic at times.
Yes. She talks about variant covers, which mm-hmm. is, you know, when do you ever see a character talk about variant covers, but it feels
and Dynamite does a lot of them. So
yeah, it's exactly what you kind of picture from Elvira in her movies as well. That little wink at the audience.
Yeah. And it's fun too, to see here. I mean, in the early stuff, since it's episodic, you see Elvira sort of moving from story to story. This is, though, cool that there's this explicitly, let's take this character and actually transport her through different stories. In this case, all historical fiction and real people throughout history. But it's mm-hmm. neat that this is the start of where we're going with our next issue on our alternate universe,
yeah.
where Elvira... Again, there's something about this character that lends itself to this meta narrative. And once it does that, you can start to bring in time travel or multiverse really organically. And I mean, we talked a little bit again before recording. Like, why do you think she as a character is so aligned with that kind of storytelling?
I think it's exactly what we were saying earlier, where the line between Elvira as a character and Elvira as a three-dimensional human being that walks the earth,
also known as Cassandra Peterson,
is so thinly veiled. I mean, so for years, I mean, now Cassandra is usually appearing at cons as Cassandra, but for many years she was only appearing at cons as Elvira. So I mean, and there's not too many other people are like that. Actually, Joe Bob yeah. Briggs is another one, because Joe Bob Briggs
is not
his
another
real name.
Persona one that we, you know, we didn't mention. Yeah.
He's John Bloom, a storied journalist who's
right,
a
right.
novelist.
Investigative journalist who's written yeah. books that are being adapted into HBO miniseries yeah. now, and but has this yeah. whole persona of like a Texan, you know, down home on the ranch, mm-hmm. beer drinking guy who loves horror movies at the drive-in. So yeah,
I think with both of them too, they're real personality. I think there's a lot of, you know, from reading or listening to her autobiography, there's a lot of that Valley Girl fun. Yeah, I mean, she's from Kansas, but there's a lot of that quality, and she was a Vegas showgirl in the actual right. Cassandra, and there's a lot of that in Elvira. So like, it becomes very thin, and that's why I think it's so great for her to be this multiverse fourth wall breaking character. What do you think? Why do you think she's so great for that?
I think it's definitely, I think that's the main reason, is that blurred line we have in terms of, is she real, is she not? Where does the line, where does she end and the character begin? But the other aspect, I think, is camp. I think she's very campy, and yes. I don't want to like go down, you know, an academic elitist rabbit hole of like defining what camp is. Because to me, it's like porn, and I just know it when I see it.
Yeah.
But I think there's something about campy, because she's, you know, campy humor and camp has something self-referential in it. So it's sort of a, maybe it's a precursor or a foundation, or maybe it's just bound up in meta textual narrative. And so I think because she's so camp, she's wink, wink, nudge, nudge. She's in on the joke with the audience. Mm-hmm. And once you break that fourth wall, I guess you can imagine, I mean, we've talked about this in some of our more recent creator interviews too, like with Joe Glass or with Carrie Harris, the way that creators who grew up in fan fiction, creators who have diverse perspectives and stories to tell, the multiverse lends itself to that, because you can see pulling stories through in universes or boxes in ways that weren't done before. And I think her character lends itself to that, because again, she's breaking the fourth wall. So you can sort of see, ooh, this is fun. What if I transplant this funny character into a different setting? And maybe the fish out of water thing is something else too, then,
yeah.
Because she's a good fish out of water. So are you ready to go? I don't want to spoil how she travels through the multiverse. So why don't we travel into the coffin and time
yes,
travel with
exactly.
her?
Yes, we'll jump into that coffin and move into the world where we are going to be exploring multiversity.
I am your guide through these vast new realities. Follow me and ponder the question, what if?
And as we mentioned at the top, today we are asking the question, what if Elvira entered a multiverse of horror movie worlds? And this is a fabulous series. You should read all of it. But today we're going to be discussing the last issue of it and the springboard for a forthcoming series. And this is Elvira Meets Vincent Price, issue number 5 from March 2022. And that's from Dynamite Comics. And this is chapter 5. Final Girl Lost.
So the story is by David Avalone. The art is by Juan Samu. Colors are by Walter Pereira. Letters are by Taylor Esperizo with Elizabeth Sharland. And this is edited by Joseph Ryband. As you mentioned, this is a mini series. This is the 5th and final issue, though it continues into something else that we'll talk about shortly. And this is the most recent, up until what we're going to talk about, mini series of her. So in this mini series, the first 4 issues, she encounters Vincent Price's ghost, and there's already a lot of meta stuff going on in that. Obviously, there's great references to Vincent Price, who I want you to tell us about in just a moment. But to finish the summary of where the miniseries starts us off, his ghost and her go through this movie set that actually is based on true history. So it's a really mm-hmm. cool thing to learn about in terms of a movie that never got made and whether or not it existed and the myths around it. So it's a cool series. And then actually in the opening of this issue, and David told us in our interview, which again is next week's episode, he was asked by Dynamite to do a 5th issue, and he had planned the story wrap for 4 and decided in the 5th issue, wait a second, this character can be transported through the multiverse. And so her and Vincent discover the legendary remote control of Federico Fellini and discover that with that remote, they can actually go into the worlds, the realities of movies.
Mm-hmm.
And so before we start talking about all that, who is Vincent Price?
Oh, well, I'm so glad you asked. So Yeah, Vincent Price, horror actor, actor in general, bon vivant, you know, real rock on tour, I think we can say.
This is a lot of like non-English words that you're throwing around here. He liked art and he was fancy.
Yes, exactly. But he's born in 1911, died in 1993. The first thing I ever knew Vincent Price from, which I'm guessing might be the first thing you knew him from, is Edward Scissorhands, where he creates... No?
Oh, no, my mother loved the Tingler and William Castle movies.
She
and
loved Tingler, yeah. William Castle, yeah. But yeah, he creates Edward Scissorhands in that. That's his one of his last movies. And but before then, he was really especially known for the Roger Corman, Edgar Allan Poe movies.
In the 60s.
I grew up definitely watching Pit in the Pendulum, but there's also the Fall of the House of Usher and Mask of the Red Death. And then he's in some serious movies as well. They're not all strictly, you know, horror. He's actually, you know, in The Ten Commandments, one movie that a lot of people watch every single year. He's in that. And yeah, we actually own a few books that he
from his library. That's true.
From his library, because he was also this huge art collector. He wrote several cookbooks. And that's what I mean. He was kind of this kooky character, which I think David really taps into in this series.
You didn't mention, I'd say probably his two most famous movies, I think, are House on Haunted Hill. Is that a William Castle?
That's a William Castle, and is also Cassandra's favorite movie, House on Haunted Hill.
And then House of Wax, also. Is that William Castle?
Don't know off the top of my head if that's William Castle. Yeah, but...
But, yeah, so that's... And those are from the 50s. Those are a little earlier, I'd say, than the Corman, right? House on Haunted Hill definitely is.
Yeah, Theater of Blood, one of my favorites of his as well. So, yeah, so many great
movies. And that's later, that's in the 70s, right? So he had a long career, and it varied...
And for the most part, you know, he has some really super serious movies like Witchfinder General. But for the most part, I think one of the reasons why he's been embraced today and, you know, very similar why he's embraced by Elvira, is there's a big camp factor to him. You know, a lot of people in comic book world might know him also as Egghead from the Batman 66.
Important detail. Yeah.
And his whole kind of persona has a little bit of that. There's like Elvira, there's always a little, you know, in many of his roles, not again all of his roles, but there's often that little wink at the camera. It's always like Uncle Vincent who's in there, not just, you know, not just Roderick Usher. You know, there's that little wink at the camera.
Well, and Uncle Vinny is Elvira's uncle from Mistress of the Dark, and that is named after Vincent Price. So that
they wanted Vincent Price to play that role, but they couldn't afford him.
That makes a lot of sense. So yeah, mashing them together makes a ton of sense, and then having that be what launches her into the multiverse also makes a lot of sense. Real quick, the legendary remote control of Federico Fellini. I mean, I am not a cinephile in that way, but of course this is the really famous Italian director and screenwriter who I think 8.5 and La Dolce Vita are probably his most famous movies. But
yes, and if you remember from her autobiography, Cassandra was actually in a Fellini film.
That's right. I wonder if David knew that when he wrote the remote control of Fellini as her multiversal. Well, I guess we know that he works closely with Cassandra actually to break the stories. So which you can hear more about next week when he's on with us. But back to Elvira Meets Vincent Price, issue number 5, her entry into the multiverse. What did you think?
Oh yeah, this is great. I mean, it's really fun. And this is kind of almost like you were saying, it's kind of a backdoor pilot to the next series, right? Because it doesn't
which I don't want to talk about yet, but yes. Yeah.
But it doesn't have much to do with issues 1-4, which, as you said, is this kind of great.
It's like an epilogue.
Yeah, you know, talk about this forgotten film. And yeah, this is kind of its own story, kind of starting this kind of talk about how these movies kind of creep into the world. You know, one thing it kind of reminded me of is some of the logic that actually Wes Craven sets up with, I don't know if you know, if you remember the movie New Nightmare, where you know, they in that movie they're setting up that they have to create Freddy Krueger movies in order to keep the real Freddy Krueger like in his own dimension. And that's like something kind of here where the horror movies are starting to creep into our reality.
Well, that's what's so cool. So if you were going to send Elvira into a multiverse, of course it would be a multiverse of horror movies. Yes. It's a very straightforward but genius idea of how to have her be in the multiverse. I mean, you know, you could have done anything, right? You could have had her, we already had her travel through time, but in terms of a multiverse, you could have had her encounter fictional characters from horror. You could have had all these things happen, but duh, movies. So it makes so much sense. And it's fun in that one. I mean, in Vincent Price 5, there is a spoof of a very real and troubling story of a director. And I'm not going to spoil it or or connect the dots here, but it is definitely based on a true story in this issue, her first multiversal encounter. I like that the director that she encounters, she then abandons in his own movie world. He's trapped there now, which is good and where he should be, because she gets the remote and then leaves. So
yeah, it makes sense that the person who's the antagonist and is starting this off is this, you know, asshole man too, because that's so much of what Elvira the character is constantly, you know, battling against, this toxic masculinity from the movie, from, you know, the movie Mistress of the Dark, through some of the other comics that we saw, the Claypool comics especially. So it just makes sense. And then it also makes sense that her guide in this is Vincent Price, who, you know, was bisexual, and her guide in one of David's other series is the drag queen Divine. So, you know, there are these strong male allies that are outside the world of this toxic masculinity.
That's true. That's true. So, yeah, I love it. It's a great setup for Elvira being a multiversal explorer. And if we're ready to move on, this issue ends on a cliffhanger because she uses the remote and discovers she's in a world of black and white, and she's in front of Block's Motel. What is Block's Motel, Rob? Why is it called that? Isn't it the Bates Motel?
It is, but Robert Block wrote the novel Psycho, so there's a nice little reference to him there. So,
all right, so this issue leads us into what we're going to be covering in our third and final segment as we talk about the future.
Yes, there's some, I just found out there's some vacancies available in.
Oh, I Conjuring thought you were going to make a Fellini remote joke. Come on.
Oh, no. Just play their music.
Will the future you describe be averted, averted, averted?
So Guido, usually I ask you, how did you come up with this list? But today I'll ask you, what are we reading? What's next?
So, well, I will explain how I came up with this list. So one of our rules in coming up with the list for the third segment is that it's something that follows the multiverse that we first encounter. Obviously, the multiverse broke open for Elvira just 2 months ago. Yes, so March there is not much. What's that?
Yeah, March 2022, so yes. Pretty recent.
There's not much that follows except the direct continuation. The direct continuation is Elvira in Horrorland, a miniseries that is not out yet, but because we had the incredible opportunity to talk to David Avalone, the writer, on an episode that will be out next week, we got to see a preview copy of this first issue and read it. So we're going to talk about it without spoiling it, but we are going to talk a little bit about what it means for the future of Elvira in the multiverse. So tell us about the issue.
Yes. So in this issue, Elvira, as we said, is brought into the... And so today we are going to talk about Elvira in Horrorland, issue number 1 from Dynamite Comics. And yes, it's not out yet, but it will be out in May 2022. And this is entitled Chapter 1, Block Party, B-L-O-C-H.
It's written by David Avalone, art by Sylvia Califano, letters by Taylor Esposito, And that's all the information I have, because there was no other information in the solicitation or on the proof copy we read. But why don't you continue the summary you had started before the credits?
Yes. So basically, as you said, Elvira is brought into the world of Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho and encounters this version of Norman Bates and Marion Crane, though their names are slightly changed here in this world. And like so many of what we're seeing in her previous series, it really blends the world between the movie, you know, being in the movie world and also being in the quote-unquote movie world. I don't know how to say that. But, like, you're both in a movie and in the
movie. And the production.
Itself. And the production, exactly. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't, we're not going to spoil anything, but yes, there are a lot of layers to this narrative. There are a lot of layers to this multiverse. So it's very, very cool. And what the series is going to be, we only read the first issue, but the rest, a few more have been solicited, and David shared a bit more about them on next week's episode. They are each going to bring her into a different movie. So this first one, as you mentioned, is Psycho. Then we have already solicited The Shining and Alien. And then he reveals on the episode what a few of the other movies that we see are going to be. So, or at least one of them. So it's a really cool setup. I mean, I think it's a miniseries. I think he told us it's a miniseries. I think it's solicited as a miniseries. But gosh, it could go on forever. You and I were talking earlier about what movies do we wish she would visit. I mean, this again, this setup is so strong. And this first issue, go get it. It is not out yet. But when it comes out, which if you're listening to this episode the week that we release this episode, Elvira in Horrorland number one is out next week, which is also when our interview with David will be out. So you can hopefully still order a copy. The order cutoff has passed, but hopefully your local store can still get you a copy. It's so fun. And if you're not into Elvira, but you're into horror movies, you need this.
Totally.
And if you're not into horror movies and not into Elvira, but you're into meta textual narratives and fourth wall breaking jokes and a multiverse, you also should get this. I mean, there are a lot of reasons to enjoy this story. And the first issue is just awesome. I mean, what do you want to say about it without us spoiling where it goes?
I'll say, too, that I think not just with this issue, but with David's writing in general, unlike some of the DC and I think to a lesser extent the Claypool, David's able to also make her a little dirtier and randier, too. Like, she's a little bit more of the Elvira, I think, from, you know, a local California cable station where, you know, not a lot of people were watching, and you could make a few more, you know, off-color jokes. And David talks a little bit about that in his interview. So it's great. it's still suitable for everyone. And that's the great thing about Elvira. Everything is said, you know, between the lines. But I think if you're reading the, you know, House of Mystery or the Claypool and you're going, oh, this is a little more maybe family friendly than my idea of Elvira, I think what David really gets into in this is like, okay, now this is the Elvira like from the 80s, you know, that we all remember. And that's what's so one of the many things that's so fun about this.
Yeah, that and the other thing I'd say, which is something you and I love being why we do this podcast, being like infomania nerds about references and like what everything's connected to. This book could easily have an annotated edition come with it.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Because it references stuff about the production and about the movie and about the actors and about the characters that if you don't know, it's okay because you can still enjoy it completely. But once you start to scratch the surface, you can actually learn a lot about the history of these movies or the story within these movies. And that's a really, really neat element. I think that's, you know, it's one of the things we've seen with sometimes the early what ifs when they would actually cite the early the issues that they were referencing. And they stopped doing that pretty quickly. I think that editor's notes to previous issues went away and was not a very popular thing, but it's something I love. I love seeing or in the Amalgam universe, seeing the fake references to other issues. You know, those are the things that you and I love and why we do this show. So to have that playing out with real histories or stories that are in our popular culture and we all know a bit of is a really cool element of her multiversal exploration.
Mm-hmm.
So any final thoughts, questions about the impact of this?
I just think, you know, with this character in general, like we were saying, you know, she can go on forever as a character in one medium or another. So if it's not live action and Cassandra, although we want to see Cassandra on screen for as long as she wants to do it. I think what's so great about this character is you can put her in all these different worlds. In Inferno, she's going, David Avalone's Inferno for Dynamite. She goes through Dante's Circle of Hell. And in the first series we were talking about, she meets all these horror luminaries from all different times. Here now in Elvira in Horrorland, she's going into the movies themselves, and really it's limitless after that. You know, we could see Elvira in space, you know, wherever, you know, she wants to go is perfect.
Well, before we wrap then, let's say, what movie do you want her to visit? We talked about this earlier.
Oh, well, the one that came first to mind for me would be really into Stuart Gordon's Reanimator and really have her tangle with Jeffrey Combs's Herbert West, because there's that, both Reanimator and Elvira have that same sense of humor. It's horror, it's humor, there's sex involved. So I think that would be a great combination. And Lovecraft, which we know David Avalone is also very interested in, that pulp world.
So I suggested that she could visit Army of Darkness, which Dynamite has the license to. Maybe that'll happen because her and Bruce Campbell are a good pair.
Oh,
but now that I think about it, yeah. I mean, I do want this series to continue forever. But I would love two movies that we both love and would be cool worlds for her to visit. I think it'd be so fun to drop her in the Blair Witch Project.
Oh, yeah. Oh, totally.
And then,
oh, my gosh, yeah.
I would also love her in Scream. She needs to be in Scream.
Yeah.
So I hope this series has a sequel, if it's a mini series, or goes on forever, and we can see Elvira in the Blair Witch Project and Elvira in Scream.
Both of those are excellent choices. Maybe they'll time the Scream. They should time the Scream series for when.
Yeah, you know, Scream 6.
Scream 6 comes out in 2023. Perfect timing.
So. That's a wrap. I have been Guido.
And I have been Rob. Thank you so much for listening.
And the reading list is in the show notes. You can follow us. Please follow us on Twitter, our only social media, at Dear Watchers.
And leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts. If you send us an image of that review, we will send you a sticker. And we will be back soon with another trip through the multiverse.
And in the meantime, in the words of Elvira, unpleasant dreams.